I hope you all had a nice weekend, but this is Monday and we have to start again. So today I'll tell you a little bit about some more linear algebra, and then the plan for this week is that by the end of today and tomorrow we're going to be talking about eigenvalues, and the reason for that is that we all know that we can take most problems in at least quantum mechanics and other fields and reformulate them so they can be viewed as some kind of eigenvalue problem, and we're going to be looking at them. And that's actually, so for the tutorial, not today, but tomorrow, we hope that you guys can do some diagonalizations and run and analyze a quantum spin chain. And actually, for if we're lucky, it depends a little bit on how good your computers are, but I think they're pretty recent, so this should work out. You should be able to diagonalize a matrix which is 2 to the power 20 times 2 to the power 20. You can do this very simply, and when I say diagonalization, in that case, if we go up to those sizes, it'll be just finding the extremal eigenvalues, and that's done with a technique that I'll tell you about, which is Lanczos technique. But then, so that'll be today and tomorrow, and then for the rest of the week, I'll try to explain to you why Monte Carlo works and what it is. And so we'll get to that. It's one of the most beautiful tricks that I know of, because in the end it ends up looking so tantalizing simple that you think this cannot be the truth. And it turns out that indeed it does work. And then when you start to think more about it, then you realize, well, how can this possibly work? But it's, of course, a technique that's extensively used in many, many fields. And if you understand it in detail, you could easily get a job in many different industries. So it's very worthwhile to learn how Monte Carlo works. And the last homework is going to be about doing Monte Carlo simulations. And Monte Carlo was, of course, famously invented by physicists for working at Los Alamos. Anyway, so I'll start with, so that's this week, and then I'll be out of your hair. So I want to talk first a little bit about linear algebra, and I think you have seen some of the things that I'll tell you about right now, but I need to remind you of how these things work, because I'll be using them later on. So what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about some elementary operations that I can do on a matrix. And well, maybe we can, the first one here, I want to just multiply a line by a constant. And in my simple-minded way of writing this, I just write li here, so the ith line, and it becomes replaced by some scalar lambda, and then times itself. So I imagine that I have my matrix, and the way I want to do this is that I want to define sort of a very, or the, how should we say this, a unit matrix, or that I want to apply to A from this side to achieve that. So we can probably agree on that if I want to do that, then most of the matrix is just going to be the identity matrix, but something special should happen somewhere, probably around line I in this matrix. So can somebody see what would I do to this matrix just to do this? Hi, it's Monday morning. How? Yeah, so we just put a lambda here. It's very simple, right? We put a lambda, and then I imagine that this here is lambda. This is entry I, right? Okay, so that's very simple. And I want to call this here J1. Okay. And the one thing to note here is that the inverse exists, right? Obviously, if I call this here for J1, then I can just find the inverse trivial. So trivially. So now I do operation 2 here. And what I want to do here, well, I want to take line I here, and then I want to replace it by itself, and then plus lambda times another line. Okay? And again, the name of the game here is that I want to do this using a simple elementary matrix. And probably, so I just want to point out, when I write a matrix like this, then everything else here is zero, right? I find that if I fill out everything with zeros, then everything gets very messy, and so if I'm not writing anything, you can count on it being zero, right? So here I again assume that we have something like this, but now what do I need to do to this matrix so that line I here, we substitute it with so let's assume here that this here's I, and I have J over here. Well, I claim that I can do this simply by putting a 1 here. That'll give me my Li here. But then over here, I should, got ahead of myself. I should put a lambda over there. Then everything else is 1. Okay. The other thing here is that I can, of course, get a little bit tricky here. I can permute two lines. So let's call this one for J2. So I can define a J3 here, and it'll just be 1, 1. And suppose that I have I here, and then maybe J is over here again. Then now I put a 0 there, and then I put a 1 there, and then I have to go down. So there's a J here, so there'll be a 1 there, and then a 0 on the diagonal. And then everything, something like that. Right. And again, I claim that these elementary matrices are, I can find the inverse. And this, by the way, is of course called a permutation matrix, because it permutes, right? Now we want to use this for something useful. So what I can do here, and that's probably what you've seen, is I can calculate the inverse of A using this. So we start here by taking our matrix A here, and then I apply one of these elementary operations to it in a cleverly chosen way. And we can talk a little bit about how one would be clever in doing this. So maybe I want to start here with J1 and then a J3, then a J2, some J1, another J2, and so forth, and then I end with a J3 here. And I choose these elementary operations on the matrix A so that the end result here will be the identity matrix. This is actually, you can try this on a piece of paper for a 4x4 matrix, and you can choose this sequence, and there's going to be a number of ways of choosing that sequence. So you can try to do this the fastest possible way or a more systematic way that might take a few more of these elementary operations. But in the end here, you end up with just the identity matrix. And then, of course, what you can see here is that this sequence of elementary operations, if I just view this as a product of J1, a product of matrices, then this sequence of product of matrices, I can see that I would have to identify that with the... Oh, there's my... This is my coffee. I don't want some non-algebraic coffee here. Let me just... Cheers.
We were talking about the inverse of the matrix, right? So you can see that the inverse of the matrix, I have sort of magically decomposed it here, so it's a product of these elementary operations, and then I've actually calculated the inverse. So typically what you would do in some kind of implementation here, you would start with the matrix A here, and then the identity matrix, and then you perform J1 on this, and J1 on that, and then you apply the next one, which I guess we called J3, and then do the same thing on the identity matrix, and then at the end of the day, then you have your J3, J1A here, which is equal to the identity matrix, and over on the other side, you have the product of all these matrices, and this you can identify with the inverse. And that's sort of a theme, so later today we'll, and actually for the tutorial today, you'll be doing something that looks awfully similar to this idea, but for finding eigenvalues. And of course, in that case, the operations here won't be of that form, but will be slightly different. So this is a strategy here that we can see that this will work, and the remaining thing is now I have to figure out a good way of figuring out what operations I should be doing and how we can most optimally do that.
let me, by the way, there's one thing here I wanted to point out, that you could see that I cheated a little bit, because I said that my elementary operations, they were defined by operating on the matrix from the left-hand side, right? I could have defined an equivalent set of elementary operations by operating on columns instead. In that case, I would have been operating from the right-hand side. In order to achieve this, I should always be working with one set, and in this case I chose the line operations, and then I can do this trick. But of course the other way of doing it is also possible. But we ended Friday afternoon by mentioning the name back substitution, so let me show you how this comes into place. So we want to solve this is actually something that would be useful and a workable method for calculating the inverse of the matrix. But suppose we're looking at a problem from linear algebra, so I just want to solve AX equal to B, then maybe I could I don't have to go all the way. Maybe I could stop before that. So let's assume that we have written this out so that x2 and then up to a1n xn is equal to b1, right? Then the next one would be a21 x1, a22 x2, and then a2n xn equal to b2, right? And then the last one here would be a n1 x1, a n2 x2, and then a nn xn is equal to bn. So now you can see that these operations here, if we think about them, if I take one of these n equations here and then I replace it with itself by and then plus a constant times one of the other equations, then of course I'm not changing the underlying set of equations. So I can sort of I can do these operations on either side here. So I can again try to think about a sequence of these operations here that would maybe not get me all the way to actually having just x1 up to xn times the identity matrix, but maybe something almost there. So I want to apply some of these operations. So maybe, well, we started here with J1 and then J3 or something like this up to, well, a sequence of these. And I want to apply them on either side here. And when I do that, then this here gets transformed into another set of equations here, where I have a11 x1 plus a12 x2, and then up to a1n xn equal to b1. Actually, you can see that likely a strategy for doing this is that maybe, if this is my starting point, then I want to add or replace this line with itself plus one of the other lines so that this term here drops out,
right? I could imagine taking line 2 and replacing it by itself, and then plus or minus the first line, so that this here would be scaled out. And I could do this systematically through the first column and then switch over here and then actually continue at that point. So if you do this, and if your initial matrix or initial set of equations here was arranged appropriately, then actually you wouldn't have to touch the first line. But let's just assume that you did this anyway. So we are going to put some primes over there, because it means that I've applied this set of equations to them. And I'm just pointing out that it, in this case, for the first line, it could actually be the identical one. But then below here, I said that the goal was to eliminate everything that was below here. So I would just have a 0, and then the next one here would start in a22x2, and now there would be a prime here, and then a2nxn, and this would be b2 prime. The next line, I have eliminated everything again below the diagonal. So this would start with a33x3, and then a prime on. And then the last thing that would be here would be ann prime xn is equal to bn prime, right? So you see that this is it's possible, and I would then end up with a set of equations which would be, if you like, be given by a triangular matrix, and this is now very easy to solve, and that crops up or in a number of occasions. So once you have basically, if you can arrange whatever matrices that you're working with so they appear triangular, then you're almost done. So this here I can solve by what's called back substitution. Have you all seen this? How many have done something like this before? It's not everyone. Okay. It's then you can tell me when I'm doing it wrong. So I look at this, and then you can see, okay, here I have this one, and above it I would have n minus 1, prime, xn minus 1, and then n minus 1, n, xn is equal to bn minus 1, prime. Right. So immediately from this one, so the back substitution, if I have it in this form here, I would say that xn here, well, it's just bn prime over ann prime. But now I know what xn is, and I can then just substitute it into the line above, right? So that would mean that xn minus 1 here, it would be equal to bn minus 1 prime, and then I need to move this one, this term over, so that would be an minus 1 n prime, and then xn, where xn is just known there, and then I divide by an minus 1 n minus 1 prime. Okay, and then of course I can continue this little game here. So xi here, it would be equal to bi prime, and then a minus a sum here of
from k equal I plus 1 up to n of aik xk, and then over ai prime. I think I may have written that right. Right, okay. So triangular matrix of this form, I can solve it by using this back substitution here. So then we get clever, because I could actually now exploit these elementary matrices to do something else, and when you work with these linear algebra methods, then quite often they do decompositions, and the one I wanted to tell you about is called LU decomposition. So, yes?
Some of the ans is really small.
Even worse, what if they're zero?
Yeah.
So, I swept that under the rock. you can see here that what I didn't tell you about is that you have to write this initial set of equations in a clever way, and by this I mean that you definitely want to avoid having these to be small or zero, but you can do that simply by permuting, you know, interchanging lines. Another case where this will go wrong is this element that I'm using to eliminate what is below this one. That's often called a pivot, and you can see if that happens to be very, very small, say 10 to the minus 9 or so, then what you're doing is likely not optimal. And what you would actually be better off doing would be to select the largest possible pivot you could at the current stage of your calculation. So you'd be searching for one of these elements here that would be as big as possible. And that turns out to be time consuming, so you don't go all the way. You try to, for instance, look in this what's below here and see where's the largest ones I have there, and then move that into place. So I'm using that one to eliminate the other one. And so there are techniques for doing that. For our purposes, what you need to understand is that can be handled simply by relabeling what I call a line in this set of equations, commuting them, and maybe redefining or interchanging x1 with x3 corresponding to what we were talking about there. But there are optimal ways, and there are less optimal ways of doing things. But you're, of course, entirely right. If we look at this, and now I want to do sort of what I did over there, so I look at 1, 2, 1, 3 here up to 1n. So now I just look at the matrix on its own, right? And then below I have So I'm, for the moment, not saying that, well, eventually maybe I want to use what I'm about to tell you about to solve a set of linear equations. But for the moment, we're just focusing on the matrix without thinking that it could be equal, should be viewed as AX equal to B, right? Because I could then see that really what I'm doing here is I'm actually performing or taking these elementary operations, and then I'm systematically eliminating elements below the diagonal. So I would go in and then, as it's called in the jargon, I'm trying to eliminate this element. Right? So I would assume that the matrix here is fairly large, and so this I would be doing if I were to do this, then the matrix that we would need for that would be of this form. Right, that's and I can't remember, I think that was our J2, we called it like that. This matrix has a property, and that property is called that it's lower diagonal. Okay. Then there's another property, and that's the fact that a product of two lower diagonal, well, maybe I should write this out, lower diagonal matrices is again lower diagonal. Okay. So how about this? Suppose I now do some operations. Let's call it J2. So there'll be a sequence here likely of J2s. I can never, you see, this is not J squared. I was never able to find a good way of labeling these. I'm just, all these correspond to some linear combination of lines, right? And I apply this to my matrix A11 up to A1n, A n1 up to A nn. And then I end up with a transform matrix A11, maybe we want to put a prime there, A1n prime. And then I have a 0 here, and A22 prime, and a 2n prime, and then 0 here, and then we end up with a nn prime, basically representing the operations that got me to this point. So this matrix here, if I call this one lower diagonal, then this here, I would call that one upper diagonal. And then you can see that this here is again a lower diagonal matrix. In other words, I have achieved something remarkable, because I have in doing that, I have actually, so what I have is I have some lower diagonal matrix times A is equal to an upper diagonal matrix. But then remember that I told you that all these elementary operations here, they had inverses. And it happens that also the inverse of one of these lower diagonal matrices is equal to a lower diagonal matrix. So what we have here is actually this, and that's also lower diagonal. Well, actually, let's write it as this sequence here of operations, the inverse of that times an upper diagonal matrix, and this here is a lower diagonal matrix. Hence, in achieving this triangular form, I have actually sort of implicitly decomposed my matrix, so it's written as a product of two matrices. Yes? Yes, that's the, yeah, it's my, it's a speech impediment. I try to, I, for some reason, I got wired the wrong way around, so I interchange diagonal and triagonal, so it should be lower triangular and upper triangular. Thanks for pointing this out. It's triangular, right? Again, to avoid any confusion, I just mean that all the elements on the diagonal and above it are non-zero, right? Sorry. I've been interchanging that for years, I don't know. Well, this is not it's not a J squared, it's J two, right? It's the yes.
Yeah. And
yes.
With lambdas being
what I'm saying is that likely what you would be doing in arriving at this point would be you would be systematically replacing, in this case, line 2 with itself and then times a constant lambda times the first line, right? And that would be done by a matrix like this that I called not J squared, it's J2, it was the second of our elementary operations. So the twos here are not squares, it's just a label. Maybe not a good label, but and so most of the operations you would be doing in arriving at a upper triangular form would be of this form. But you know, maybe at some point you also wanted to interchange a line, it doesn't really matter. Okay. But it can be done with these elementary operations, and the inverses exist, and then we have actually so this is lower triangular, and this is upper triangular. Okay. And that's so it's one of many ways of decomposing matrices, and this is called an LU decomposition. You asked me a couple of days ago how I can now calculate a determinant efficiently. If I look at the determinant of A here, it's the determinant of L here times the determinant of U. And calculating a determinant of a matrix that has this form is now very simple because it's just the product of whatever is on the diagonal. But suppose now that I want to solve this equation here with a number of different B's. Then I can actually get very clever here because I can look at suppose I want to solve now AX equal to B, and after that I want to solve AX here equal to C or something like this. In other words, I keep the matrix, I use the same matrix, but I vary B and C here. Then I can and look at this, and then I say, well, this is LU here on X is equal to B. And then I say, well, how about looking at that and say I can write this as L and then times set is equal to B. And then UX equal to Z. And the beauty of this is, of course, that I just told you that whenever substitution, whenever the matrices had this triangular form that we achieved here, then I can solve this very simply using back substitution. I do get now two sets of equations, but they're almost trivial to solve, right? The payoff, if I'm only doing this once, might not be great, but if I'm doing this many times and I have the LU decomposition of the matrix, then this is actually very efficient, right? I can do this. Okay, so and Friday we talked about if I wanted to do this at a very large scale here, then that's possible. Okay, so let me now. I want to tell you a little bit and you know there are various different ways of doing these decomposition techniques. I want to tell you about something that you use every day. And so where do you in everyday life, and I bet that you all do this at least twice a day, use or a problem or a solution from a problem from linear algebra or eigenvalue problem on a current basis? Well, you do this when you use Google. So I just want to tell you about PageRank here, not just because I find it interesting. And there's actually a slight point to it. So this was actually a basis of a U.S. patent from 1998. I know that some of you may not be born in 1998, but I can remember that far back. So so you know the story, right? This was Larry Page and Sergey Brin that was. At least one of them was in grad school at Stanford, and they, of course, famously didn't finish because they came up with this little concept. So at the time when this, this is, of course, a problem from information theory. So in 1992, and yeah, you weren't born then either, but I installed what was at the time called Mosaic, which was a predecessor for Netscape on a computer. Because somebody had heard about it. So the first web server came live in CERN in 1991, December 25. So this was just a few months after that. But then what we did when we installed the system is we looked at all the web pages in North America. Right? Get it? All of them. And they were all listed on a single page. And then, so we clicked on all of them, and we decided, well, there weren't any really useful stuff there, and then we just removed Mosaic, and then it was just a few months later, then suddenly we decided that, well, maybe we should try again. Of course, the amount of web pages had tripled, and then after that, then one had to use search engines and so forth, and most of them, of course, initially just gave a listing of all the results. If you search for something, then it would just list all these pages. But as we all know today, that is useless, because if you search on something on Google and it returns 2 million pages, you know, that's useless, right? You can't look at 2 million pages, so you need a ranking for them. And that was, of course, done by Larry Page and Sergey Brin in the late 90s. So their idea was to attach an importance to the page. And so we have to figure out how we would do this. So I'm going to do my mini web here. And my mini web here, I'm just going to assume that I have just 6 web pages, okay? It's the entire World Wide Web. Is it? It's not right what I... okay, so the way I want to do this is I'm gonna say that some of these pages will point to the other one. So let's assume that page 1 here, it points to 2, and it points to 3. And 3 here points to 1, 2, and 5. And 5 points to 4. And it points to 6. And then 6 is very, there's only one outgoing link, so it points to 4. And 4 here points to, points back to 6, and it points over to 5. So their idea was that if I, so I'm going to call the nodes here, I'm going to call this, the nodes here, the web pages, I'm going to call them PI, right? And then I'm going to say that the rank now of PI here is given by the sum over all the pages that links to it, right? So I'm going to do a sum here over PJ pointing to I, or PI. And what we're going to do here is that I'm just going to sum up the rank of those pages, and then dividing with what you might call the cardinality. So I define PI here as the number of outgoing links. In other words, if I get a link from a site that links to millions of other sites, then I'm not going to get a high score from that. Now, if you look at this, then you can see, of course, that the rank here is determined in all the other ranks. So I could actually write this as a matrix equation. So if I look at rank 1 here, rank 2, rank 3, rank 4, rank 5, rank 6 here, then this is actually a big matrix. And then rank 1, rank 2, up to rank 6 here. And then I have to figure out what that matrix should be. But basically, what I need to put in here is just 1 over the number of the outgoing links. And I have to do this in a correct manner here. So when I look at the rank of the first web page here, it has only one incoming link, and that's from 3. And 3 is actually linking to 3 other sites. So I would have to do 0, 0 here, and then a third, and then 0, 0, 0. Then I look at rank number 2, then there actually, or page number 2, there are actually 2 sites linking to it. There's 1, and that is linking to 2 other sites, so that's a half. And then I also get from page number 3, that's a third. And then I have 0, 0, 0, and then we go to number 3 here. Well, there's page number 1 linking to it, so I get a half from that. And then that's about it. Right. That's the only one that's linking to that one. And then I go and look at now number 4 here. Well, I get a link from page number 6, and that only has 1 outgoing link, so I get this one there. And then I also get a link from number 5 here, and number 5 has 2 outgoing links, so I get a 1 half there, and then 0, 0, 0. And then the 5th one here is 0, 0, a third, a half here, 0, 0. And then the 6th one is 0, 0, 0, a half, and 0. Okay, so now you just have to imagine that what we're doing here involves all the pages on the web, right? So it's no longer something you can do in Mathematica. Not everything can be done in Mathematica. The size of this is gigantic, right? It would be a billion times a billion or something like this, but it's possible to solve this. You see something here that's interesting. If I add up each column, then I get 1, 1, 1, 1, and oops, I get 0, and then I get 1. And the 0 here, I get that because site number 2 doesn't have any outgoing links. And so Page and Brin, when they looked at this, then they said, well, actually, if a web server, they thought about people that were surfing this graph, so they were running around between different pages. If they end up on page number 2, there are no outgoing links. So what they do is that at random, they just choose any other site to go to. So this one would be substituted by a whole column, which would be 1 over 6. In that case, we arrive at a matrix which is called a stochastic matrix, because all the columns sum up to be 1. And we can, and many properties are known about these stochastic matrices. Actually, they added a little other trick to it, but we're not going to really talk about this. All I wanted to tell you is that you end up with a big honking problem from linear algebra, and that's actually what is running on your computers here. Well, you don't solve this every time you do a search, otherwise we wouldn't get anywhere, right? So they rank the web pages, I believe, on maybe a weekly basis or something like this. What they did here was that they would iterate this. So for a stochastic matrix, it has certain nice properties, so I can iterate it. So I could get the vector at iteration k plus 1 here by taking my matrix here and then apply the previous ranking vector to it. And then I iterate, and then I could hope that I would achieve convergence. And so there are various ways of looking at this, and maybe you want to say that another way of looking at this is I need to find the eigenvalue of this stochastic matrix, which has an eigenvalue of 1, right? So there's big money to be made if you can do this efficiently. Solving huge problems in linear algebra, etc., is a very useful thing. So Google has a number of tricks, and they have very interesting software technologies that they're somewhat secretive about, but this one is fairly well known. So I like to tell you about this problem because clearly I would have to probably use an iterative technique, and this brings us to sort of the next thing that I want to tell you about, and that's eigenvalue problems. I want to tell you about what you need to know for doing the tutorial this afternoon. It's a method here that's called called Jacobi's method, and it's, I think, probably the third method we're going to talk about that's called Jacobi's method, so it becomes confusing because we don't know what we're talking about. It's what we would call a dense algorithm because we want to find all eigenvalues and all eigenvectors, as opposed to just finding a single one of them. The reason why I like to talk about this one, because there's a whole host of these algorithms, it's very, very stable, and it's one of the fail-safe algorithms. If anything else won't work, then Jacobi's method here will likely work. The other great benefit is that I can sort of tell you how to implement it in the last minutes that remains of this lecture, so it's fairly easy to understand, and it's in almost any library that you'll come by, so it's not the fastest method, but it's probably the most stable one. As I said, we can implement it fairly simply, and then we can say that, well, maybe there's a few optimization tricks that we can leave the libraries to do. So what do we want to do here? What's the idea? We want to look at what's called a similarity transformation. Deep sighs from the audience, right? So what's a similarity transformation here? Well, I define a matrix C here, which is some matrix like this one. And so what I'll be talking about here, I'm going to assume that A here is real and symmetric. Basically, anything that I'll be talking about when we talk about eigenvalues, we assume that it's real and symmetric. In physics, you will, of course, say, well, I should actually be using a Hermitian matrix, so it could be complex as well. Anything that I'll say, it can be what you might call complexified. So the same algorithms would work if I used complex numbers. It would just add on obscurity. So for what I'll talk about, I'm just going to assume that it's real and symmetric, okay? Which is not a severe constraint. Then, of course, there are other interesting classes of problems where the matrix is not symmetric, or maybe you want to look at generalized eigenvalue problems and so forth. I'm not gonna look at that. What will happen here? Well, suppose I look at AX is equal to lambda X. And then I apply T here on either side. So then I have some equation like this. And then I'm going to say that x here is equal to the inverse T here, and then operating on y. So that would actually mean that TA T on y here is equal to lambda y. So if I look at the matrix A and compare it to the matrix C, you can see here that they have the same eigenvalues. And eigenvectors are related by this relation. X is equal to the that. Okay? C is defined this way, and that's A. Didn't, wasn't that what I said? Oh, okay. Well, yeah, so the idea is that I'm talking about C and A. Yes. When you ever, soon you'll be up here at the blackboard and teaching everybody else, right? Anyway, what you sort of become myopic, because after a while you can see the entire blackboard and I can see sort of a few letters. So I think it's right. If things don't look right, then please scream out. Okay, so what we're going to do is that we're going to, I like to think about this as the eigenvalue version of this Gaussian elimination that we talked about earlier. So I'm gonna assume now orthogonal transformations. So I'm gonna assume that T inverse here is equal to the transpose of T. And then I'm going to look at, guess what, the what we might call an elementary transformation here. But I'm going to look at the simplest orthogonal transformation. And so remember when we did the line interchanges, then I had an elementary operations. I'm going to do the same thing here. So I'm going to write it. I'm going to write it as almost all ones here, but then lines P and Q and the corresponding columns will be slightly modified. So here I'm going to put C, and over here I'm going to put an S, and then I'm going to continue with one on the diagonal here. And then here, I'm going to put another C. Well, I guess it should be down here. We'll put another C. Here, I'll put an S, and then we go over. Right, and then we put some ones on the diagonal. When we look at this and we remember when we talked about the other elementary operations, so this is what I'm going to call T here, you can see that actually what this one does here is a slight rotation, because I'm not taking just one line and representing or replacing it by itself and lambda plus another line. I'm actually modifying two lines simultaneously by simply replacing those two lines by a linear combination. Yes? Of course they are, because I'm going to assume here that the transpose here follows this quantity. And so if we impose here that t minus 1 here times t, or, well, the transpose times t here is equal to the identity, then you can see that c squared plus s squared, it has to be equal to 1. Right? So you can think about them that s and c here are the cosine of an angle and a sine of an angle. And actually what we have done here is that I take two basis vectors of the Hilbert space, and then I rotate them, they remain orthogonal, right? Both of them have been rotated slightly. And then, of course, I'm going to take another pair of basis vectors and rotate them slightly. They remain orthogonal to all the other ones. And so, like clockwork, I do these rotations, and then I end up actually having modified the basis vectors of the Hilbert space. So in that new basis, the matrix becomes diagonal. And in doing that, I've actually rotated things in. So I'm working now in the basis where that are defined by the eigenvectors of the problem. OK, so that's the name of the game here, that we want to achieve here. So I sort of want to do, so the goal here is strikingly similar. I want to do a series of these t's. Maybe I'm going to put them a little label down here, t1 to tn, and then on a here, and then t1 inverse, and then tn inverse, and then that ends up being a diagonal matrix. So it sort of a strange similarity between this and doing the Gaussian elimination. Okay, so all we have to figure out now is a strategy for doing this, and that turns out not to be very hard here. So what I need to do is I need to look at A here, and then let me do part of it. So I end up with a C here, then a minus S, and a C, and then an S here, right? So that's part of the transformation that I need to do to do this. I'm going to call this A prime. And that matrix, we already know this, that what we do here is I'm going to take the lines P and Q here and replace them with something else. So lines P and Q are changed. Nothing else is done, right? Because we know this, because I told you about how these elementary operations work on matrices. Now I need to do the other step here. So I need to look at A here and then imply or use the inverse. But the inverse here is just the transpose. So I have an S and a minus S here. And I do that now on A prime. And then I end up with a matrix that, let's call it A double prime. And maybe it'll look something like this. So this would be P, Q, P, Q. So the end result is, of course, as promised, that I've only touched column P and Q and line J and Q. Now, when we look at this, I can actually write this cleverly. And so how would we do this? So in Fortran, I could say, well, if all I'm doing is modifying line P and Q, I can write this efficiently as this, right? I'm defining now the pth line of A prime, and that should be C times the pth line of the original matrix, and then minus S times the qth line. Right, so this I can do in one line in Fortran, and I redefine the this entire line, and then I do the next one, so that would be the qth line here, and so that would be S now times the pth line, and then plus C times the qth line, right? And then I just go down here, and then I say, well, I have to do the same thing now, but I'm doing column operations, so I can look at now the pth column, and if I follow what's written here, it should be C here, and then times the pth column of A prime, and then minus S times the qth column, and then a double prime here, the qth line, it's just S times A prime, and then P here, and then plus C A prime, right? So I can write this entire similarity or transformation or orthogonal transformation in four lines in Fortran, and these now operate on all the elements at the same time. If you're a MATLAB fanatic, then you'll realize that this looks awfully lot like how you would do it in MATLAB. So what we want to do now is I can just look at these equations here, and then let's look at APQ double prime. In other words, the element that's sitting there. And if I just read out what is written there, then you can see that it's equal to S here, and then APP prime, and then plus C times A prime PQ. I got that just from reading that line, and then I just go up above here, and then I look at what APP prime is, but that's C times APP, and then minus S times AQP, and then plus C here. And then I get the other one here, which is just C times APQ here, and then minus S times AQQ. Just reading off from that, right? So if I write this out here, then I get SC, and then APP minus AQQ, and then plus C squared minus S squared AQP. Okay, so what we want here is that I'm working my way towards a situation where the matrix is going to be diagonal. So if I choose now C and S here so that APQ double prime is equal to zero. In other words, I can use this equation to determine the rotation angle. That'll set that element to zero, and since the matrix is always going to be symmetric, it'll always set that one equal to zero, and then I can continue. So I just need to, from this equation, determine the rotation angle, right? So if I do this, you can see here that I have C squared minus S squared AQP here, It should be equal to SC and then AQQ here minus APP. Okay. So if I divide over here, then from this I can look at AQQ here minus APP and then over AQP. And this is going to be equal to C squared minus S squared over SC. And then I'm going to be a little bit clever because I'm going to stick in a factor of 2 on either side just because it makes things work out a little bit easier for some trigonometric relations. This one I'm going to call alpha, right? It's just determined in terms of the entries of the whatever was the elements of the untransformed matrix. And I'm hoping that this is going to allow me to determine what the angle is. And so if I look at this, I have the 2 alpha SC here. That's equal to C squared minus S squared. And I divide here by C squared, right? So I divide by C squared. And what do I get here? If I do that, then I get 2 alpha T here. And then I get a plus T squared and a minus 1 is equal to 0 with T equal to S over C. In other words, the tangent of the angle. And so now we have determined the angle that we want to rotate by, and we're in business. The only thing I want to say here is that if I solve this one, then we have that T here should be equal to minus 2 alpha and then plus minus 4 alpha squared plus 4, the square root of that over 2. And if I divide up by 2, then I get minus alpha plus minus the square root of alpha squared plus 1. Yes? Yes, you're probably right. The you know, these are just trigonometric relations. There's a little trick to it. I determined it here in terms of the tangent, and you can see, if you remember what we started to talk about, then you can see that maybe we're going to have a cancellation occurring here. So if we want to do this, we should take the smallest root. So stable if the smallest root is taken. That's sort of a golden rule. Whenever you're trying to do something that will require a lot of operations, try to do the smallest thing you can do. In other words, so what we're doing is just we're rotating 2 vectors and then another 2 vectors. And here what I'm saying, try to rotate by the smallest angle. There will be 2 solutions here, so I could take the big angle and I could take the small angle. And here we want to take the small angle. So if alpha here is less than 0, then the smallest angle would be minus alpha here, and then minus alpha squared plus 1. Okay. If alpha is bigger than 0, then it would be minus alpha and then plus that 1. And that means that actually I can combine this so that T here is the sine of alpha, and then over the over alpha here, and then plus the square root of alpha 1 plus 1, right? If you doubt this expression here, I can multiply through. So you can just see that it becomes equivalent to that one. Okay, so once I got, once I have t here, then I can get c here as the square root of t squared plus 1. And then I get s here as t over c. Okay, so then we basically have determined the angle, right? Alpha is written here. And all you have to do is just do this, right? Yeah, so that's alpha, okay. So the way it works is that you start with your matrix, which has some form like this, right? And then we don't touch the diagonal. But then we start with this element, and then I do the appropriate rotation here, defined by these equations. And then maybe I want to do the next one over. So I go through the upper row here, and then I go down one row below it, and I do this one, and I do this one, and then I end here. This defines what we would call one sweep of the upper so I call this the upper diagonal, or the elements above the elements above diagonal. And now, when we want this to converge, we should maybe then look at what would be the sum over all these upper diagonal elements after we've done a sweep like this. And a realistic implementation would do something like this. But by experience, I can tell you that you just perform 10 sweeps and you're done. Right? So I just run through these elements above the diagonal 10 times. Each time I do something like this, and I've diagonalized the matrix. Beautiful, right? And the transformations are written here. There are two things I need to tell you here. If you wanna, if you look now, then in the end we'll have some diagonal matrix here, and it'll be some t's here, our a, and then some other t's over here. So t transpose. And if you remember, then I can write this as some u dagger or u t here, and then a here, and then u. And in doing that, you realize that actually the product of this series of matrices is nothing but a matrix where the vectors are, or the eigenvectors are the columns of this. In other words, just when we looked at this Gaussian elimination, if I just keep track of the operations that I do on one side of the matrix, And I do this by applying them to the identity matrix. At the end of the day, I'll end up with a matrix where I can just read off the columns, and they'll be the eigenvectors. And that would just correspond to doing half the work that we did here. The other thing here is we need to look at how this converges. So I can show, I need to end here, that after a single transformation, suppose I look at a sum here, which is the sum over all the elements that are off the diagonal. Suppose I look at this sum, and then I do a single transformation when I eliminate one element above the diagonal, and then I look at the sum over the elements after that, then it's easy to see that this is just the original sum here, and then minus APQ squared. In other words, you could get worried that I do a transformation setting this element to zero, and then in the preceding operation on this element, the entry that you had set to zero here becomes non-zero, and indeed that will happen. But if I look at the overall sum of what is above the diagonal, I can show that it actually goes down systematically with each rotation that I do, and quickly converges to zero. And that's the magic of this algorithm, that I can show you this rigorously, and you don't have to worry a lot. You do a few, it sweeps through a matrix, and you can be fairly certain that anything that was above the diagonal has been completely eliminated. And you have a diagonal matrix, and you've done everything, and all you need to do is just four lines of Fortran code.
Is that
totally
independent of the size of the matrix?
No, not really. It's as I've never come by a matrix that, well, from my personal experience, you need to do 5 to 6 iterations. If you have some huge matrix, if you have a really huge matrix, you wouldn't really do this method, and it's possible that maybe you need to go to 12 iterations. The point is that it's not going to be 1,000 sweeps. And typically, if you look at pull an implementation out of this routine out of a library, they'll have a cutoff in that maybe you can do 30 iterations or something like this. Then they just say that there's been something wrong. And typically, what will go wrong is that you feed in a matrix, and it turns out that it's actually not symmetric or something like this. And then, of course, this is not gonna be working out. Typically. Yeah, you're right that you should actually put in a proper convergence criterion. And if you have the time this afternoon, you can try to think about one. And it's not hard to do. For the tutorial, we just wanted to get something that you could actually write on yourself in a few minutes, and it would diagonalize a matrix, and it works. And then you can worry about refinements later. So that's the tutorial for this afternoon, and sorry for taking it. Any questions about this? Because you're going to be, you see how we would do this? You're going to be doing it for the tutorial in an hour or so, or 2 hours, or, well, maybe you're going to skip the tutorial, but I, of course you won't. You won't, right?
Say I could look through everything that's above the diagonal and choose the biggest element, and then try to set that to zero. And that's a good strategy, except for finding that element is costly. So what I'm proposing here is just something very much simpler. I'm just going to run through them in sequence. If you want to get clever and say, I don't want to run through this way, I want to go down that way,
or maybe sort of dovetail, so I go through like this or whatever, then do as you please. But you're right. You can achieve faster convergence if you have the possibility of selecting an element, but typically that's expensive to find the biggest one.
That's interesting. You talk about convergence, but isn't this like accurate to numerical precision?
Yes. So what I'm saying is that one criterion, I could look at the sum of the absolute square of the elements that's outside of the diagonal. And each time I do an operation, I claim that that sum should decrease. But when I say convergence, I mean what's the fastest possible way of getting that number to decrease. And if you believe me that I should just be subtracting the square of the element that I rotated or set to zero, then by going through the largest elements here first, I could get it to go to zero faster. So how I'm going to converge basically to zero will be set by the sequence of steps that you do here. And there's sort of optimal ways of doing that. Anyway, what I'm saying is that for practical purposes, we can make do with just the simplest possible thing. Let's go have lunch.
So the tutorial will be 1 hour.